Support for this podcast comes from Wise, a universal account for over 50 currencies. Wise is the only account you need to go global. Whether you're converting pesos to pounds or dollars to dong, Wise makes it easy to manage your money across borders. You always get the real exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees, helping you save on currency conversion wherever your money takes you. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com/world.
Brits lined up for miles to pay final respects to their queen. The queue had to be cut off somewhere.
I got my wristband. The luckiest people. Aren't we lucky?
Also today in Kyiv, far from the fighting, residents are trying to get back to a semblance of normal life. Some Ukrainians are uncomfortable with the idea of returning to bars and cafes while their country is still at war.
I don't think it would be cool when we drink beer in war time.
I'm Marco Werman, and at this week's UN General Assembly in New York, world leaders each get a few minutes at the lectern. There are some old tricks that will help them stand out from the nearly 200 speakers. Props, name-calling, or just powerful oration.
Who will get up and stand up?
All that and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Today in London, one of the largest funerals in modern history. The coffin of Queen Elizabeth II was pulled by sailors of Her Majesty's Royal Navy. Members of the royal family followed in a massive procession of military regiments, bands, and dignitaries. Tens of thousands of people lined the road. Today was the culmination of 10 days of national mourning following the Queen's death on September the 8th. Beginning last Wednesday night, close to a million people inched forward in hours-long lines for a chance to walk by her casket on display in Westminster Hall. This morning, Britain's new king, Charles III, accompanied his mother's casket to nearby Westminster Abbey. Some 2,000 invited guests were waiting in the cathedral. Dignitaries spoke, including the Archbishop of Canterbury and Prime Minister Liz Truss, who delivered a prayer from John 14:2.
In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you.
Following all the hymns and prayers, the Dean of Westminster Abbey, the Reverend David Hoyle, pronounced the blessing.
God grant to the living grace, to the departed rest. To the church, the king, the common...
As the service concluded, congregants and Britons everywhere stood for the national anthem, getting used to the change in lyrics. God save the king. Outside of Westminster Abbey on the streets of London, it was eerily quiet. Reporter Rebecca Rossman was there and has more.
Every detail of the funeral was signed off by the Queen herself before her death. If it all seemed so perfectly choreographed, that's because it was. Some 4 billion people tuned in from around the world as London came to a standstill on Monday from the early hours of the morning.
Well, I'm walking down Edgware Road towards the mall here, and I'm just passing all the shops. You know, everything's closed except for, I would say for a few bodegas here. You expect things like banks to be closed, of course, and, you know, boutique shops. But here I'm passing a pharmacy here. It says, "We at Safer Pharmacy share in the nation's deep loss and sadness at the passing of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. And then they have a notice saying, "It's only right that we alter our operational arrangements on the day of the funeral to ensure our healthcare team can participate and show their respect to." So even pharmacies are going to be closed today.
Lines of shops plastered similar messages on their window fronts alongside images of the late queen. Supermarkets, bakeries, even McDonald's was closed so that staff could pay their respects. Ceremonial music played as thousands piled into Hyde Park to watch the funeral on one of the giant jumbotrons. 67-year-old Jill Wilson shows me a 4-foot stuffed Paddington bear she sewed together herself for the occasion.
Sounds pretty inspired.
The lovable brown teddy bear became associated with the Queen after they made a special sketch together to mark her platinum jubilee last June. Free screenings were also available at 150 cinemas across the country. Doreen Henderson decided to watch from this theatre near London's West End.
I don't think this has ever happened in the UK before. Yeah, like live screenings. They do it for musicians sometimes, but not funerals.
Others went for the pub experience. Here at the Ship Tavern, first opened in 1549, silent customers took delicate sips of their pints as they watched the final moments of the hour-long service held at Westminster Abbey. The 2,000 carefully selected guests invited to stand inside the Abbey included U.S. President Joe Biden, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and French President Emmanuel Macron. There were also those who were noticeably not invited, like Russian President Vladimir Putin, along with the leaders of Belarus and Myanmar. Even with nearly two decades of preparations, one of the thorniest tasks for the organizers was balancing diplomacy and security. Despite attempts by the British government to restrict traffic by having world leaders transported by bus, high-profile dignitaries were, in the end, allowed to bring their own vehicles. Some onlookers caught a glimpse of Biden sitting inside his armored presidential limousine, known as the Beast, Monday morning after he got stuck in traffic near Marble Arch Tube Station. London Metropolitan Police said the funeral was the, quote, largest single policing event the force has undertaken, even more challenging than the 2012 Olympics. And then London went silent for 2 minutes as part of the funeral ceremony. Crowds scattered along the mall remained quiet as the Queen's hearse made its way across London before being taken to Windsor for a family service. And finally, interment. She was buried alongside her husband, Prince Philip, who died in 2021, and the many royals that preceded her. As the ceremonies came to a close, onlookers like Simon Warren and his young son Freddie began to ponder the royals who will follow her.
It's sad that she's died, but now we have a king.
I think the biggest thing for us is that in our generation, we'll never see a queen again, I don't think.
And while many shied away from talking too much about the newly crowned King Charles III, polls show he faces an uphill battle to match the popularity of his late mother. He has big shoes to fill, Warren says. Shoes that may have been better fit for the Queen. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in London.
Last night was the final chance for ordinary Brits to pay their respects to the Queen. Reporter Leo Hornack was there.
Christina, from the town of Tilbury in southern England, was one of the very, very last people to get an official yellow wristband.
I got my wristband. The luckiest people. Aren't we lucky? Aren't we lucky? We are the last luckiest. We are lucky.
The wristband that entitles anyone to enter Parliament's ancient Westminster Hall and pay your final respects to the Queen in person. It's a warm, clear night, just before midnight, and we're standing on London's embankment, with the River Thames lapping quietly on our right. We're at the very end of the legendary queue, or line, that has entranced Britain for the last 10 days. The queue at one point stretched 10 miles along the banks of the river, with wait times sometimes nearing 24 hours. A visible monument to the people's devotion, using our own bodies to send that message. Christina is one of those who's dressed for the occasion. A British flag head wrap and a long dress.
I'm wearing a very elegant African dress, white, with my flag on my head. Respect to our Queen.
You look amazing, absolutely. Picture of elegance.
Thank you very much.
A few yards behind Christina and another few dozen people, it all ends. No more wristbands, no more queue. The line is closed for business. Just some staff in high-vis jackets separating those who will make it in from a few hopeful latecomers. From here on, the day belongs to the politicians, the royal family, the international dignitaries.
I said to myself, no matter what it takes, I have to be here tonight to give her the last respect. I call her mum. as a citizen, I know her. She's a mother to me. So her death is like a slap on my face. I will not lie to you. I cried. 4 p.m., 15 minutes past 4, on the 8th of September, the news came in, and I broke down. And I'm still shaking till now.
I can see you're still emotional
yes,
right now.
Yes, I am. I'm going to see her now.
As we keep walking, there are signs of the largest peacetime security operation in Britain's history moving into action. Squads of soldiers in camo jog past regularly. Police mutter into walkie-talkies and have intense conversations with teams of ushers and security staff. Here in the queue, we're an unfortunate intrusion into these arrangements. You can feel that. The only element of the ceremony where an ordinary citizen can turn up uninvited, unannounced, and share a personal moment with royalty. But that's also why it's sacred for another few hours.
She's my queen. She's like a mother.
I have a confession to make. Unlike Christina, I don't have a wristband. And we're approaching the stretch where you can't follow the queue any further without one.
This land belonged to her. And she gives so many people opportunity to come to the land and live like a British. Give them all the opportunity that they wanted.
Were you one of those people?
I am one of those people. My parents are one of those people that she gave opportunity to be in England.
And then all the king's horses and all the king's men, or at least his ushers, decide that my journey is over and our interview is cut short before I can even get her last name. Only Christina and her friends can go any further. Wristbands, please.
Wristbands, please.
Oh, wristbands.
Cheers.
Sorry. I'm just interviewing her.
Correspond?
No, I don't. I'm just interviewing her.
Then you won't be allowed to go in.
Okay. Beyond this point.
Okay.
Christina and the last of the queue go forward. The metal security gates are dragged shut for the last time. The rest of us must wait outside, by the river, for Her Majesty's final chapter. For the world, I'm Leo Hornack in London.
For some, it can be hard to fathom why anybody would wait out in the cold, standing overnight to see a casket. But what's been happening in London is not unique. We thought we'd take a brief look at other funerals that had massive turnouts. According to the Guinness Book, the funeral of the charismatic C.N. Annadurai in India in 1969 holds the record. It was attended by 15 million people. Anandurai was a politician and hero among Indian Tamils. He fought to give oppressed social castes in India equal rights. Then there was Iran in 1989. The funeral for Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini. Estimates put the turnout for the Islamic Revolution's philosophical founder at 10 million. It's not just political or spiritual leaders, though, who get the big crowds. The great singer Kulthum was seen as a maternal figure by many Egyptians. When she died in 1975, some estimates put the mourners in the streets of Cairo at several million. Then there was the fatal 1994 crash in Italy that killed Brazilian Formula One driver Ayrton Senna. When his body was returned to Brazil, 3.5 million people paid their respects. The television coverage was wall to wall. If we're talking long funeral lines, then you'd have to go back to Soviet Russia. When singer-songwriter Vladimir Vysotsky died in 1980, Russians stood in a 6-mile queue to pay their respects. This is Vysotsky's song Wolf Hunt that spoke obliquely about the Soviet state through metaphor and street slang. The Kremlin may have ignored Vysotsky's songs and poetry, but not the throngs who saw the artist as someone who spoke up for them. Of course, there's much more news outside of the Queen's funeral today. We've got more coming up later in the program and more online, like what's going on in East Africa, where a multi-year drought is devastating the region. Somalia is bearing the brunt of it, with more than 1 million people displaced. The world's Halima Gikandi traveled to the district of Baidoa to report on the people hardest hit by the drought. Check out her reporting on our website, theworld.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Two huge storms are barreling across the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. In Japan, millions are evacuating as Typhoon Nanmadol brings record-breaking rains and strong winds. In the Caribbean, Hurricane Fiona battered Puerto Rico on Sunday. The governor there described the damage as catastrophic. It's still too early to know the full extent of the damage, but power was knocked out across the entire island. We managed to contact someone in the capital of San Juan to tell us more. Ramon Luis Nieves is a lawyer and former senator in Puerto Rico. I asked him what he's seen since last night.
We are almost to the date, 5 years after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, and this has caused massive flooding in some sensitive areas all over the island. We have already had a loss of life already. We are better prepared now for this kind of disasters. What we have seen is that our infrastructure isn't. Our electric grid was down 100%. We had a 100% blackout. We have lost running water. So it has been quite difficult. And maybe the lesson learned here is that the people are better prepared. The government isn't.
I mean, as you say, Hurricane Fiona is coming at pretty much the exact same time as Hurricane Maria in 2017. Just for comparison, how powerful is this storm compared to Maria?
In comparison to Maria, Hurricane Fiona, the winds are had less intensity, making landfall, but the amount of water, of rain, some experts have said that it will reach historical levels for the island in terms of the inches of the flooding. So, and, you know, it has already caused a lot of damages in certain areas of the island.
Right. So, I mean, the U.S. invested a lot of money in upgrading Puerto Rico's electrical infrastructure after the last storm. The grid is now under management of a Texas-based company, Luna Energy. It's supposed to withstand a Category 2 hurricane. Why has the situation not improved more?
Well, there's a difference between appropriating money and actually spending it. What happened was that we're talking about the Trump administration. The federal government really appropriated more than $9 billion. Let's put it at $10 billion to assign it to Puerto Rico to rebuild the grid. However, there was a controversy over the funds with the Trump administration, and the funds really didn't get released or made available until the last months of 2020. However, since that time until now, 2 years later, there's been almost none of those of that amount of money has been really spent to rebuild the grid. So there's been no actual impact of those $10 billion in the grid to finish them off.
So how should Washington be trying to help the island right now?
The federal government, they must insist on cutting the red tape and allowing for the projects and forcing even that the projects to rebuild the grid start, because the money is there. This is not a money problem. This is a problem of inefficiency and bureaucracy. So I guess the federal government must push for the government of Puerto Rico to really kick off the projects. Second of all, to convince them to, you know, to do away with the contract given to LUMA and doing a difficult thing, which is working with the government of Puerto Rico to create a new public entity to manage our electric grid and power generation.
Right now, though, because of Hurricane Fiona blackouts across Puerto Rico, when do you think the power will be restored?
I hope so sooner rather than later. Right now, while we're doing this interview, we're suffering from the blackout here in my home. I really hope that we can get away from the blackout. I mean, there's something. I guess most Puerto Ricans, we suffer from some kind of PTSD from disasters and the storms. After Maria. Maria was quite traumatic for us. So being without power for days or months not only affects you personally, but also kills the economy. So it's quite challenging, you know. So that is why I think that it's so frustrating that the government of Puerto Rico did practically nothing in the past 5 years to go through the process of creating a better grid for Puerto Ricans and allow for the creation of different solutions for communities, because we are almost at the same spot as we were in 2017.
Ramon Luis Nieves is a lawyer and former senator in Puerto Rico's legislature. He joined us from San Juan. Ramon Luis, good luck to you, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
With LED light bulbs, it was love at first sight. They're not expensive, they last longer than incandescent bulbs, and the demand on energy that releases carbon emissions is low. But it turns out there's a downside. A new European study on the outdoor use of LEDs says their increased blue light radiation is causing substantial biological impacts. Translation, sleep problems. Alejandro Sanchez de Miguel is the lead author of a study that appears in the journal Science Advances. Alejandro, your study found that blue light radiation suppresses the hormone melatonin. So break that down for us. What does that mean for us humans, first of all?
Melatonin is like the director of our hormonal system. Tell us when it's night, how to sleep, and when we should be awake. And by disrupting it, we disrupt not only the melatonin itself, but also change digestive hormones, we change insulin, we change all growth hormones. So it means a lot of disruption.
And your study documents sleep problems in both humans as well as other animals. Which animals have you studied?
In this study, we focus ourselves in moths because they are pollinators. We also focus on bats. But the research shows that this impacts migrating birds, seabirds, turtles, nearly anything. Because even diurnal animals need to sleep at night. And nocturnal animals depend on the darkness to not be hunted by predators. So this impacts nearly everything.
Your focus was Europe. Does Europe rely on more LEDs for outdoor lighting than other parts of the world?
What we see in Europe is that there's a lot of differences between countries. For example, the Belgians are very conservative. They have changed not that much, but the UK has already replaced the 50%.
I mean, everyone was feeling so good about LEDs, a high-tech climate change solution that provides a nice light as well. And now this news. Is there an alternative that is environmentally sound and also less intrusive to sleep and just biological function?
The problem are not the LEDs themselves, but which LEDs. And for example, the Department of Energy of the US saw this from the beginning, and that's why they did a lot of outreach, planning, try to buy only good quality LEDs. Now we have LEDs without blue light. We only need to buy them. If you have the resources, you have the money to invest, do it with LEDs, but do it with proper LEDs. Warm LEDs, 2,200 Kelvin LEDs, dimmable, and only use the light where it's needed.
Alejandro, let me put you on the spot. What kind of light bulbs do you use at your home?
Oh, I love that question. what I use is bulbs that are dimmable and that change color when I dim it. And yeah, it's LEDs.
Those are in the kind of orange-red spectrum of LEDs, yeah?
Yeah.
Is there any evidence that towns and cities will switch to better LED lights?
No, there's no evidence that they are going to do the right thing. Because if we only matter of the only metric that we care is about the energy efficiency, you will still use the wrong ones.
Alejandro Sanchez de Miguel is a researcher at Complutense University of Madrid and the lead author of a study just published in the journal Science Advances on LED lights and how they disturb human and the sleep of other animals. Alejandro, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
You're listening to The World. President Biden is now saying the pandemic is over. The nation's top infectious disease doctor is not so sure.
We still have a situation that we must address. 400 deaths per day is not an acceptable number as far as I'm concerned.
My conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In a number of cities across Iran today, people took to the streets, chanting anti-government slogans. Details are murky, but there were reports of several deaths after authorities launched a crackdown. What sparked the protests was the death of a young woman on Friday. Her name was Mahsa Amini. She died soon after being arrested by the so-called morality police. It appears that Amini was accused of not following strict religious dress codes for women. The World's Shirin Jafari has the latest.
22-year-old Mahsa Amini was from the Kurdish city of Saqqez in northwest Iran. She was visiting the capital Tehran with her brother last week Speaking to Iranian news media, Amini's mother said that the siblings caught the attention of the morality police as they were stepping out of a subway station. The police arrested Amini, her mom says, as her brother pleaded with them not to take her away. Eyewitnesses say officers forced Amini into a van.
She was transferred to a detention center. And within a day, she's in coma, completely brain dead. And within the next day, she's pronounced dead.
Hadi Qaimi is the director for the Center for Human Rights in Iran. He says there were other women in that van, and their testimony confirms that Amini was beaten by officers.
Most probably the fatal blows that resulted in her death is during that time when she's taken to the van, in the van, and before she's put inside of a detention center.
The Iranian government says Amini suffered from a pre-existing condition and she died from sudden heart failure. Authorities released a video which they claimed was shot inside the detention center. It shows a woman walking towards the guard. She speaks with the guard for a few seconds and then suddenly collapses. The video then cuts to a scene where medics are taking her away. The woman's face cannot be seen clearly, and the video has no time or date stamps.
The family maintains that she was beaten.
Gisunia is a human rights lawyer with the Atlantic Council. She says photos of Amini taken while she was lying in bed at the hospital seem to show signs of trauma.
There have been different medical doctors assessing the situation from afar, looking at the photos of Mahsa and noting that there's discoloring around the ears. It looks like there's blood around the ears that's typical of a concussion.
Officials in Iran say there needs to be an investigation. But similar cases in the past have almost always gone nowhere. There are strict laws in Iran that require women to cover their hair and their bodies in public. Iranian women have long pushed for changing them. Nia says these are the most visible part of a wider discriminatory laws against women.
Which has impacts on custody laws, laws of marriage, inheritance. So this visible manifestation is not just a side note. It clearly is enforced through violence, and it relates back to a very comprehensive discriminatory legal framework against women.
Hundreds of protesters went out to protest in Iran today. Anti-riot police were deployed in Tehran. In one video posted to social media, the police are seen beating and using water cannons against the protesters. All this is happening while Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, is visiting New York. He's taking part in the United Nations General Assembly. Hadi Qaimi says world leaders should use this opportunity to bring up human rights in Iran.
Anyone who meets with Raisi in New York, from diplomats, bilateral talks, press conferences, private meetings, everyone should bring up the case of Mahsa and the crisis of impunity in Iran.
Meanwhile, Iranian women are participating in protests in different ways. Some have posted videos of themselves online cutting their own hair. That's a symbolic gesture of mourning and sorrow. Also, musicians have made tributes to Mahsa Amini. This one's an Iranian rendition of Bella Ciao, an old anti-fascist protest song from Italy. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
World leaders are arriving in New York this week for the United Nations General Assembly. The annual gathering gives them the chance to speak on a global stage about critical issues impacting their nations and the planet. The so-called general debate is also a moment that often brings great political theater. The World's Jason Margolis looks forward to what we can expect and casts back briefly to where we've been.
For world leaders coming to New York, a chance to address the UN General Assembly is a really big deal.
The speech that they give to the General Assembly is one of the most important they give any year.
Rachel Kite is a former special representative of the UN Secretary General.
They're communicating a foreign policy position for a domestic audience, as well as presenting their credentials and their leadership and their concerns and agenda to the rest of the international community.
Kite, who is now the dean at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, has been to more than a dozen UN General Assemblies. She says it's the only place where every country gets a voice.
No matter its size, no matter how rich it is, and this is where the international community comes together. This is where we convene.
At this week's general debate, it'll be a room filled with big personalities, protagonists, and politics. David Sheffer has seen this. He served a couple of stints at the UN and is now with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says the annual fall speeches by world leaders are also important because foreign ministries from around the globe are paying close attention.
They take stock of where the views of 193 countries are. It's an index of world views.
But for the general public, 193 speakers is a lot. A few sound bites will make the evening news back home, then quickly be forgotten. But a few speakers will hit the mark, and their words could be remembered for years, even decades. Former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was one of the masters of standing out from the crowd. He was a fan of props.
Brought a diagram for you.
In 2012, Netanyahu held up Here's a drawing diagram. Of a cartoonish bomb that looked like a cannonball with a fuse. The image was divided into sections representing Iran's progress toward enriching enough uranium for a bomb.
Where should a red line be drawn? A red line should be drawn right here.
Speakers are asked to limit remarks to 15 minutes. Many blow well past that. In 1960, Cuba's Fidel Castro spoke for 4.5 hours. Bombast and name-calling also work well. In 2006, Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez had some choice words for the American President George W. Bush.
Yesterday, the devil came here, right here.
Then there was 2017, when then-President Trump threatened to destroy North Korea and threw in a demeaning nickname for its leader, Kim Jong-un.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
And one final tactic to grab the spotlight, the protest. First, there's the walkout, when leaders stand up and leave during a speech. Or in rare cases, the interruption. The most famous one came in 1960, when Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev took off his shoe, waved it in the air, then reportedly banged it against a desk to interrupt the Filipino speaker for speaking about Soviet aggression. Rachel Kite from Tufts mentions another, more dignified way to stand out from the crowd of speakers.
Well, you have natural-born orators, and I think this year look to not the biggest country in the world, but look to Barbados and look to Prime Minister Mia Mottley.
Who will get up and stand up?
Mottley captivated the hall at the UN last year in New York when she quoted reggae singer Bob Marley.
Who will get up and stand up for the rights of our people? Who will stand up in the name of all those who have died during this awful pandemic? The millions. Who will stand up in the name of all those who have died because of the climate crisis?
So which global leader will make their mark in New York this year? David Sheffer says he's circling his calendar to watch President Biden and the representative from Russia. As of now, they have no specific speaker listed.
Let's see who will speak for Russia. But whatever the Russian says will be listened to very carefully. I think there'll be quite a bit of cynicism in the hall, and you might see some walkouts as well.
Whatever they do end up saying, expect some drama. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
You know the saying, only in New York? Walking around the city, you'll definitely see some curious and unexpected things. If you happen to be taking a stroll through Central Park this weekend, you might have run into Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Hey. Oh, wow. Thank you. Turkish President.
Erdogan is one of the leaders who came to New York to take his turn at the General Assembly podium. But before his speech tomorrow, he decided to take in some sights in the Big Apple, including a walk in the park where he seemed pleased to speak with others on their strolls.
Oh my goodness, really? Can I shake your hand?
A video of his seemingly unannounced meet and greets was posted online by Turkish state-run media. In the video, President Erdogan sits on some benches and has a meal at the famous Low Boathouse in Central Park. Some people came up and asked for pictures. Others offered words of affirmation.
We love you so much.
Another person thanked Erdogan specifically for grain and drones. Now, this soft and fuzzy image is the one that the Turkish government wanted to show. What's not known is whether the Turkish leader got any Bronx cheers during his Central Park visit. You know, those things you hear only in New York. As the Ukrainian military advances on the battlefield, Russian forces are responding by attacking Ukraine's civilian infrastructure. Last night, a Russian missile exploded about 300 yards from a nuclear power plant in the south of Ukraine. There was no direct damage to the facility, but the head of Ukraine's national energy company said there is no other way to characterize this except for nuclear terrorism. People in the capital city of Kyiv are now far from the front lines. When Russia first invaded Ukraine, the city was under threat, but Ukraine's military repelled the Russian attacks. As the world's Daniel Offman found when he was on assignment in Kyiv recently, residents are now trying to get back to something resembling normal daily life, even as their country remains at war.
At first glance, everything here looks normal in this CrossFit gym in northern Kyiv.
My name is Marina Halata, and I'm a CrossFit coach here in CrossFit Banda Abalin.
Are you here every day?
Almost every day, except Sunday.
Halata says sports and working out have been part of her life since she was a kid. That's why she missed it so much when the war first began.
First 2 weeks, we were not even training, and we were not even thinking about that.
Halata was glued to her phone following the news. Russian troops were closing in on Ukraine's capital, and she was worried about her safety.
I'm living on the 21st floor. First days, there was a little bit scary to live like that high. So me and some of my friends, we were staying here like first days. That gym, it's like underground, so it was a little bit safer.
Even so, Russian troops were seen in this area, right on the street outside the gym. In late March, though, Ukraine's military pushed Russian troops out of the Kyiv region. That was a turning point for people here. Alyona Shumakova is the director at the gym.
Було прийнято рішення, що дуже багато клієнтів, ну, людей писало, що, ну, вже хочеться, ну, як-то переключатися.
Shumakova says they reopened because many gym members reached out to her. They said they needed the gym as a distraction from the war. But Shumakova says when they did reopen, things felt different. Lots of members had already left the country, and some were still nervous about going back to their regular routines.
Нет безопасних мест. Безопасность – это очень тонкая грань. Ну, мы все понимаем, что ее нет.
There are no safe places, Shumakova says. Air raid sirens still go off frequently in the city. And there are reminders that the war is not over, like the sandbags and military checkpoints all throughout the city. In the center of town, this cafe and bakery is packed with people. Sofia Bilan is waiting tables. She tells me about what life was like here when the war started.
At the first month, we work like a volunteer center. We prepare a lot of meals for the grandmas, grandpas, children. We open our doors like a free restaurant. The guests can make like order for free.
Bilan says many of her friends got out of the country right away, but she stayed, spending most of her time right here at the cafe. She says she didn't even think about leaving.
This is my city. I born in Kyiv. This is my country. And I'm also make a little deals with the volunteers. They also my family. So we stay together.
Just a couple of blocks away at the Gulliver Mall, people are shopping, going to the movie theater, and hanging out. Yegor Safonov is working the register at the cosmetic shop. At first, he says, hardly anyone was here shopping. But gradually, more and more people started returning to Kyiv, and they started to get more customers. People wanted a distraction from the war.
Конечно, не чувствуется так, что все хорошо, потому что начинается тревога и все начинается какая-то.
But Safonov goes on to tell me that life is not really back to normal. Whenever there's an air raid siren, he rushes to the bomb shelter, and says he feels a sense of panic. Yulia Balaba, a shopper here, says she feels the same way.
For me, it is a little bit difficult because I'm thinking about siren, and it is strange, and it is very. I'm afraid of this.
Yulia is visiting Kyiv for the weekend. Right now she lives in Vinnytsia, a city southwest of the capital. But she's originally from Mariupol, a city now occupied by Russian forces. She left there back in March.
I feel sad about the situation and I want to go home to my parents, to my house. My parents are still in Mariupol. They live there. This is a big problem for my life.
Yulia is in touch with her parents, but she says not being able to see them in person is tough. Shopping is a nice break from her daily routine. On the bank of the Dnipro River, there's a pedestrian walkway with shops, outdoor cafes, and bars. Two cyclists, Bohdan Shevchuk and Anatoly Chernevsky, are kicking back having a beer. The two friends start to debate whether or not that's appropriate during a time of war.
I don't think it would be cool when we drink beer in war time.
I disagree. I think that's okay if it's not too much. We should do what we can do and we should like relax to be more productive next day. So it's okay if one or two beers.
Shevchuk then explains why he's not 100% comfortable with beer drinking right now.
My colleague is near Donetsk. It's too close to war. Of course, I support him. I pay salary, but I can feel myself relaxed when he is under hell. He is in hell.
Shevchuk says getting out on a bike ride is a good way to clear his mind and remember what life was like before the war started, when things really were normal. For The World, Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Starting to feel that little bite in the air? Autumn arrives this week in the Northern Hemisphere. In other words, more time indoors. The third autumn during COVID. It makes many of us wonder where we stand with the pandemic and whether the shape-shifting Omicron variant will continue to defy expectations. In an interview that aired last night on 60 Minutes, President Joe Biden said the pandemic had come to a close.
We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape.
This morning, we reached out to the nation's top infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci. I asked him if he agreed with the president's assessment that the pandemic is behind us.
What the president, I believe, was referring to is that stage where we were having 800,000 to 900,000 infections a day and over 3,000, close to 4,000 deaths per day. That's very different from what we are doing and seeing and experiencing now. However, we still have an issue and a problem with COVID. 400 deaths per day is not an acceptable number as far as I'm concerned, or as far as public health people are concerned, particularly in this country, Marco. That's very disturbing is that we only have 67% of the population is vaccinated, and only one half of those have received a boost.
I mean, the president did walk a fine line and seemed to offer two views of the pandemic. Is it responsible for Biden to say the pandemic is over, especially when we've seen what happens when a new variant arrives? I mean, numbers can change so radically.
Yeah, and the president is very well aware of that. I think he was just talking what was considered to be in common language for the American public. But we don't want people to put their guard down. We want to make sure they understand that there is the danger out there that people are getting infected and people are dying. 400 deaths a day is not an acceptable number. Right now, we have available to the tune of 171 million doses, a updated vaccine that is specifically directed to the BA.4/5 variant. We really need to make sure that people don't get the impression that it is not important to get vaccinated.
So how is this new booster that's going to target the Omicron variant, how is it going to change the equation, not just in the U.S., but globally?
You've heard us say this may mean vaccinating everybody with an updated vaccine every year. For some individuals, it might even mean more than once a year. Now, I know that's an inconvenient thing for people to have to go through, but you really have to balance, particularly if you're a vulnerable person, an elderly person, or one with an underlying condition, that that's something that may be necessary to maintain your health.
What do we know about what this new booster can do to prevent long COVID, speaking of severe disease? What does the data say at this point?
We do know something that is clear, that people who are vaccinated have less of a likelihood of developing long COVID when they get infected.
So just to go back to Biden's comments on 60 Minutes, he held up evidence that no one is wearing masks, which doesn't really tell us anything except that people are tired of wearing masks. It feels, though, right now like the world is living in two parallel universes. One universe where people are masked, quarantines are taken, and there's caution. And another where the pandemic is in the rearview mirror. Are we stuck with that split screen? And what problems does that create?
There is a divisiveness in this country that is a political divisiveness that sometimes spills over into the arena of public health. And people, you know, for one reason or other, seeming to be divided along ideological lines, are accepting or not of public health interventions. And when you don't have a uniformity of adherence to good, sound public health measures, it's just going to prolong things because more people will get infected, people are going to get seriously ill, and you're going to get less of an effective control of an outbreak if you don't have somewhat of a uniformity of adherence to public health principles.
I'm speaking with Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci, for nearly 40 years, you've been leading the fight against infectious disease in the U.S. Much of your early career was focused on HIV/AIDS, but you've been on the front lines of messaging for avian flu, for Ebola, so many other crises. And now you're preparing to step aside at the end of the year. What do you want to be remembered for?
Well, in general, I want to be remembered for someone who put all of their energy, all of their passion, all of their commitment into preserving and protecting the health and the welfare of the American public. And since the United States is such a leader in this space, that indirectly doing that for the rest of the world. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that together with George W. Bush, and he deserves great credit for that, he asked me, and I did, become the principal architect for the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which has now clearly saved about 18 million lives throughout the world.
I mean, we have to say in that time, you've also been something of a lightning rod. Do you think the person who takes your place will inevitably feel the same thing? Is that just going to happen?
I doubt if it will happen to that person as an individual, because that individual was not put in the position that I was, where I had to, as you recall, Marco, from the time I spent as part of President Trump's White House Coronavirus Task Force. I didn't take any pleasure in this because it was uncomfortable, but in order to preserve my personal and scientific integrity and to fulfill my responsibility, which is my primary responsibility, to the people of the United States, I had to do something that was very uncomfortable, and that was to publicly contradict the President of the United States. You know, I then became, as you know, essentially the public enemy number one for the people who follow President Trump's every word and everything that he says and does.
And I know you paid a personal price for that.
I did. I mean, that's not what I intended to do. I didn't take any pleasure. I have a great deal of respect for the presidency of the United States. But in order to fulfill my responsibility, I had to speak out. And that made me essentially the boogeyman for the far right.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Anthony Fauci has served as the top infectious disease official for the U.S. over the past 38 years. He'll be retiring at the end of this year. Dr. Fauci, very good to have you with us again. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you for having me.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.